Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the Oxford Development Talks, the series that's taking some of the best research and thinking in international development in Oxford and trying to make it as broadly accessible as possible. I'm Mia Simovic, President of the Oxford Society for International Development, and my co-host today is Alexander Betts from the Oxford Department of International Development. This week, we are joined by Professor Catherine Costello, who is Professor of Refugee and Migration Law in Oxford, and, as of the 1st of July, Professor of Fundamental Rights and Co-Director of the Centre for Fundamental Rights and Harty School of Governance in Berlin. Catherine is a lawyer who has published widely on many aspects of EU and human rights law, including asylum and refugee law, immigration, and EU citizenship. Her book, The Human Rights of Migrants and Refugees in European Law, was published by Oxford University Press in 2015. Catherine is going to talk to us today about migration control and human rights in the pandemic era.
Catherine, really I can't think of anyone better placed in the current context to help us all understand and navigate some of the impacts of the current pandemic on human rights. Particularly the human rights of people who move. We've got travel restrictions, we've got barriers on movement that are affecting a whole variety of people, not least migrants and refugees. So Catherine, we're delighted to have you. Welcome to the series.
Thanks a lot, Alex and Mia, for the invitation. I should also thank my colleague, Dr. Angela Sherwood, who's been doing some research on this immense and vast and very fast-moving topic with me. Alex, as you said, I mean, the pandemic has been characterized by pretty massive restrictions on mobility and other human rights restrictions. And I think what's happened so far, which I think is really remarkable, is just that human rights have been pretty central to the discussion and to shaping the response, at least in some states. And that's really what I want to discuss. But I'm also conscious that this is a development studies series, and I'm a legal scholar, so I have to perhaps open with at least an acknowledgement, if not an apology for that. So I thought it'd be useful at the beginning of my talk to talk about what are human rights in the sense that I am dealing with them in my scholarship and use that to sort of set the scene a little bit. So when I talk about human rights in my work, I'm invariably looking at human rights in a legal sense and in international law in particular. In some of my work, I focus very much on European human rights instruments, the European Convention on Human Rights, for example. In this talk, I'll talk about international and European instruments, but I'm also talking about domestic constitutional protections in some cases, because it's at the domestic level that human rights are often most effective, and that's where they take shape. So you have a sort of an imperfect reflection of international human rights commitments in national constitutions. But of course, human rights aren't only a legal discourse. I mean, they're a set of ethical precepts, and that's really important to bear in mind because that's where you get useful criticality and you get the ability to critique what international human rights standards do or their limitations. For the listeners for this series, I think there's some just basic contours of human rights I think are important to sketch out at the beginning. So most people are familiar with the idea that you have sort of a set of rights in an international bill of rights, that there are certain human rights that are legally protected, like the right to life or freedom from torture, freedom of expression, those classic civil and political rights, and also that certain economic, social, and cultural rights are regarded as human rights, like the right to health or the right to food and so on. Often these types of rights are enshrined in different instruments, but not always, and they're treated differently. But I guess in human rights thinking, they're thought of as indivisible. So, for example, where's the line between the right to life and the right to health? It's not a sharp line in any event. And I think what makes the difference really is that when you think about the obligations that human rights generate, they generate obligations both to respect the right, but also positive obligations to protect and fulfill it. So the duty bearers, who are typically states, but not only, which I'll talk about in a moment, are obligated not just not to kill people, you know, to violate the negative right, but also to take positive steps to protect the right to life. And I think that's been crucially important in the pandemic context, because obviously if states and governments do nothing or they don't do enough, then they also endanger human rights. And so those positive duties to take measures, including in some cases restricting other human rights, might actually be obliged by human rights obligations. And so they're very careful balances to be struck. I think one of the other important things about positive obligations is that if the state puts people at higher risk of their human rights being violated, that increases the extent to which the state has positive obligations. So if a state, for example, detains people, it has stronger obligations towards them because it's put them in a legally vulnerable position. Or many courts have acknowledged that, say, asylum seekers are in a legally vulnerable category because they're often prohibited from working. And so if you can't work, then the state has positive duties to ensure that you don't fall into destitution. And I think the other important sort of conceptual aspect of human rights that to bear in mind is that some rights are regarded as absolute. So the right not to be tortured, for example. But most rights are qualified rights, which means that public authorities can sometimes interfere with them if there's a justification. But that the whole process of justifying restrictions has to be done in a very particular way. And there's a sort of an established framework for thinking through justifications for rights. So it's unquestionable the pandemic involves massive restrictions on human rights. Most of the time, the question is, are those restrictions justified? And generally speaking, in very broad brush, when parliaments and courts and other bodies address those questions, what they ask is, are the restrictions legal? Are in the sense that have they been enacted in law so everybody knows what the restrictions are? Are they proportionate? So do they go only as far as is necessary? And are they non-discriminatory? If you have rights restrictions that discriminate, then that puts their legality in doubt. And I think that final point on discrimination is really crucial because it's such a live issue in pandemic responses. Because let's say if you have a set of restrictions that fail to consider certain populations that might be vulnerable, or actually discriminates in some way in the sense of, you know, leaving out or bearing down particularly heavily on particular populations, then that changes the legal character of the restrictions. Sometimes it would put their legality in doubt. Other times it would suggest that the measures are under-inclusive and have to be adapted. But certainly human rights law in general is sort of infused with a non-discriminatory ethos and requires us to think particularly carefully about whether types of measures that are facially neutral actually discriminate, be that on grounds of race or on grounds of age or on grounds of sex, obviously, and gender. Or it asks us to think about existing social structures and whether putting in place blanket measures will actually leave some people, you know, in peril or in danger of other human rights violations. So I think one very obvious example of that is the impact of lockdown restrictions in the context of domestic violence, and whether if the home is a dangerous place for women or children in particular, whether there have to be adaptations. But I think the thing about human rights really is that it doesn't answer these questions, but it sets up a fairly robust framework of inquiry. And then what we have to think about is, well, what institutions exist to sort of give effect to, and where do we actually ask these questions and scrutinize the extensive restrictions that are being put in place during the pandemic?
That's incredibly interesting, incredibly clear. So we've got a set of agreements that states have committed to internationally, regionally, domestically, a set of principles that they've all agreed on and that have been shaped over time by behavior about what it's ethical to do and what it's ethical not to do. And that creates obligations to not do some things, but also actively to do certain things. And that seems to mean that there are certain things that even in a context like a pandemic, governments shouldn't be doing or should still have to do, and ways in which their actions shouldn't be discriminatory. But I suppose your last point is very interesting. It's to say, well, if these norms exist, if these laws exist, what gives them power? What makes them have effect? How do we know that law can work to change government's behaviour? When and how does it have either teeth or an impact on government's behaviour? How can it ensure that governments do the right thing even in a pandemic?
Well, I think the answer to that question varies across the globe. Obviously, in some regions, you have pretty strong domestic protection of human rights. So national courts whose rulings are effective, but also national political systems that take human rights pretty seriously. So, for example, in the UK, all of the pandemic-related legislation would have been scrutinised by appropriate parliamentary committees, writing very detailed reports, and a legislative process where human rights were taken seriously. And I think that applies in many, many states across the world, both in the global south and in the global north. Domestic courts are one obvious forum. They're also regional human rights institutions. They don't exist everywhere, but they exist in many regions. And I guess what we know from the very best empirical scholarship about human rights, so I'm thinking there about scholars like Beth Simmons or Catherine Sitkink, is that human rights tend to be impactful, yes, when you have domestication, so it has to really be at the domestic level if you want to effectuate political change. But when there's a combination of the transnational or the international leverage, and that you really need a combination of factors to make rights real at the domestic level. I think what makes the pandemic very challenging is obviously everything is happening very fast. And usually we don't think of courts as being institutions that are good when you're in a hurry. It's a very slow method of achieving political change. But I think in some contexts, courts have been very effective during the pandemic in terms of the sort of interim orders that they have been granting, which have really shaped pandemic response in a lot of different places. I think the final point I would make about human rights, and this might be more about human rights as a standard bearer for activism, is that I guess just to acknowledge that they are also that. I mean, if you think about political change and the current context, I mean, the Black Lives Matters movement is currently highly impactful. It's not only a human rights movement and not everyone in it would style it as such, but social movements are impactful under certain conditions, and litigation and strategic litigation are often a tool of those social movements. So a lot of the litigation that I've been following has been brought by pioneering, often very small strategic litigation NGOs, and they've had a massive impact with very slender resources as well.
Thank you, Catherine. If we now relocate human rights law back to the context of COVID-19, there's been a whole series of very substantial changes to mobility rights and laws, such as lockdowns on the domestic scale, people not being able to leave their homes or neighbouring areas, but also on an international level where air travel and cross-border travel has also been stopped and halted and gradually reopened as the lockdown measures are relaxed in various countries. So could you outline for us what the role of mobility laws and regulations have been in the context of COVID-19?
So I think just first of all, when we think about human rights and mobility, we have to acknowledge, and this has been a very strong theme in my work, that human rights law and the human rights system is statist. So it does take states and borders for granted. And the way that human mobility rights are framed really does distinguish between internal free movement and international free movement. So the view is that there is a general human right to internal freedom of movement within states, and that nationals of states have rights to leave and re-enter their own state. So nationality is almost built into human rights law in this particular way, but that foreigners can't really assert a right to enter other states, although they do have a right to leave any state. So there's an asymmetry built into human rights instruments. So I think if we bear that in mind, it's one of the reasons why I think actually if you spend time, as I do, looking at human rights and rights of migrants and refugees, you find they often are treated exceptionally. It's because migration control is sort of written into human rights protections in a way. But if we think about internal free movement, obviously most states in the world have adopted pretty significant internal mobility restrictions, which I think for most of us, we've never experienced before. I think some countries, Asian countries who had experienced SARS, had experiences of some mobility restrictions for public health reasons. For many of us, these are unprecedented. Of course, they're not for asylum seekers and refugees who often don't have an internal right to free movement that states respect, although they ought to have. In many countries, people have actually just challenged the lockdown straightforwardly, very frequently actually relating it to freedom of religion. So there were challenges in Germany and in the US and many other countries constitutionally about the right to freedom of exercise of religion. And I think the German cases were interesting, and the German courts dealt with these on an interim basis very quickly, saying, yes, this is an interference with your right to freedom of religion if you can't leave your home and attend church services, but it looks proportionate given the evidence. So there's a sort of a filter of rationality when justifications are examined. And also noting often, and I think this becomes really important, that restrictions are temporary. I should say there was also a really lively debate in human rights law about whether states should be invoking formal states of emergency to actually formally derogate from human rights in light of the pandemic. But I think for the most part, although it might seem obvious that these restrictions were justified, I think the way that courts say they are justified, provided that, and they require certain types of justification to be offered, or they say they're acceptable because they're temporary and this has to be reviewed again. I think that's kind of typical of the structure of both human rights and constitutional review. That's quite an important check on executive power. I think the second dimension that I really wanted to mention, which might be of particular interest to development studies audience, is that in really a lot of states, and I'm not sure I have a complete global overview of this, in fact, I probably am sure that I don't, there were very interesting early challenges to lockdowns when it became apparent, as it immediately was, that for many people, if you can't go out, you won't be able to earn a livelihood and you have no resources at home. So if you think of typical scenarios of, say, not only refugees, but the precariat in many countries, day laborers, and those at the bottom end of the labor market with no job security or social protection, formal social protection. Asking somebody not to go to work would mean very quickly the family had no food. And in quite a number of jurisdictions, this was sort of, states obviously realized this, and food assistance and other kinds of social support were put in place. But in others, it was actually NGOs and courts that were turned to in order to establish that. So there've been orders of that nature in Malawi, in Nepal. I think in other contexts, one of the issues that came up was about, well, let's say so-called internal migrants, and whether, if they were typically economically insecure, they had to be allowed to return to their home places. So in breach of or adapting lockdown to allow people to return home, or otherwise providing greater food and social assistance. And from what I've looked at in the context that I mentioned, those orders were fairly impactful, although obviously that's something that would have to be studied in a lot more detail. In some contexts too, there were immediate litigation about access to healthcare and testing. So for example, there's an NGO in East Jerusalem, Adala, which brought cases about the lack of testing and medical facilities in East Jerusalem in two particular refugee camps, which obviously aren't camps in the sense that some listeners might think of them. They're just densely populated areas of East Jerusalem where Palestinians live. And in some countries too, the quarantine conditions have been challenged if the quarantine conditions were in and of themselves not suitable to protect public health. And I think in a lot of countries where governments adopted very strict quarantine rules for their own nationals coming back, there was a legislative process where people argued that formal quarantine in hotels or in other places of detention or restriction weren't suitable, and that people should be trusted to quarantine at home. Which brings me to one other kind of observation that I think there's just a burgeoning set of questions about here, is that often these sorts of blanket measures have been justified given the nature of the public health threat. But it does seem that states that have managed to avoid those sort of blanket restrictions, the alternative is systems that involve a lot of electronic surveillance. So when you get to a point where you have adequate testing and tracing, and of course that raises massive privacy questions and questions about data protection and security, which is in and of itself just a huge, big, massive, hot issue in human rights law. But it's a complex one because you have usually got a mixture of public and private actors involved. You're talking about the state contracting out often a lot of very significant functions. And also you're not really only talking about human rights law, although it's very clearly a human rights issue, particularly the privacy dimension, but also there are a whole lot of issues about data and data ownership that are partially regulated by human rights law, but not only. But for me, I think what's been striking in watching this sort of unfurling is that courts have been pretty nifty, and in a context where one wouldn't necessarily always expect that, you know, in giving sort of interim orders that have been quite carefully tailored. And it does seem to me at first glance that look like they've been pretty impactful, particularly on the food security questions.
It's really remarkable to hear how, despite quarantine and lockdown having really significant implications in terms of people's access to the possibility to earn a living, the possibility to access food, the implications on really basic human rights, we've seen courts play an active role, that despite everything that's happening, litigation has been strategically used in different parts of the world to ensure that there's a challenge to some of the practices of governments. I wondered if we could turn now from the domestic internal mobility aspect to the international realm, because one of the areas that you've highlighted is the effect that the current context is having on people's ability to leave and re-enter their own countries.
Yeah, and again, I think these are rights that until now we sort of took for granted, or certainly you took for granted if you were sort of a member of the fairly privileged global traveling elite. And I think it's fair to say in most states have put in place very extensive restrictions on international mobility, at least at the beginning of the pandemic. There are a couple of exceptions, and there's a global overview which IOM provide, which is quite interesting. But generally speaking, but not uniformly, but generally, the exception in terms of an ability to travel is a national of a state returning home. And that's kind of what you would expect in the scheme of international law, that privilege of nationals to return to their own country would be respected. But of course, it hasn't been uniformly respected. And I think it's interesting to see the exceptions. I think one of the most high profile examples of a state that didn't allow its own citizens to return home was Nepal. And I think there were some dubious practices also in India. And you were really talking about states who didn't want their guest workers to come back home from other parts of the world. And I guess that tells you something about who a state values and who a state doesn't value. I guess from that point of view of understanding what we classically understand of the privilege of citizenship, the ability to live in your own country, some states weren't respecting it. In Nepal, again, as I mentioned, that restriction was also legally challenged and I think successfully. So that notion that you could have stranded migrants who are just legally unable to return to their home countries, I think was quite striking. Of course, materially, a lot of migrant workers couldn't return home because they don't have enough money or they're too indebted to return home. But that might be a different question. I think the right to leave any country is always really interesting to mention, because although the right to enter your own country is one that we all take for granted, I think we often forget that human rights law also gives everyone a right to leave any state. And I think of this sometimes as a forgotten human right. Western states used to get very exercised about it in international human rights fora during the Cold War, when communist states didn't allow people to leave their own country. And we all then thought that this was egregious. But nowadays, when the right to leave isn't very well respected, because of externalized migration controls, it's not debated or discussed or even invoked in court cases very often. But I think it is a human right, but it's not an absolute right in any event. So I think if you're in a public health context where you can justify sweeping internal mobility restrictions, then a fortiori, it's probably possible to justify restrictions on the right to leave any state. I think the real challenge comes, and this is probably what listeners might be more interested in, is that when it comes to people who aren't just leaving for fun or for livelihoods, but for survival or for protection, and where the right to flee or the right to claim asylum or seek asylum is, where does it sit in the current era? And I think here the pattern that we've seen is that, you know, the rights of refugees and the rights of people in general to flee and seek protection, as we know, in many parts of the world are already under immense strain, and states engage in a whole lot of pretty egregious violations. And I think some of the states that were already engaged in pretty egregious border practices in particular have just used the pandemic as a very poor excuse to have even harsher policies. So I think this would hold in relation to the US southern border in particular, but also it seems like the practices of European states like Greece and Malta in the face of maritime arrivals, which were already pretty egregiously unlawful, they've been adapting new policies and practices. So I might just mention the US, because I think listeners might find that particularly interesting. And I think it's interesting for lawyers, because there are a whole host of restrictions at the US southern border that are, I mean, certainly under international law, illegal. In terms of family separation, lack of access to asylum procedures, which can amount in practice to refoulement, very dodgy safe third country practices with Mexico and other Latin American states. But what I think is interesting in the pandemic era is that there have been measures passed by the Centers for Disease Control in the US, which to be lawful need to be reasonably based on public health concerns, but which are both drafted and institutionalized in a way that really doesn't make them plausible as public health measures and seem to be just quite a full frontal attack on any form of access to asylum. And I think scholars who've written about this, legal scholars, are pretty clear that it's very difficult to see how these measures could be legal, even not under international human rights law, which is difficult to invoke in a US context, but even under domestic law in the US. But I think that disingenuous invocation of public health here is particularly interesting. If we think about Greece, I mean, the situation in Greece with regard to reception conditions, as they're called in Europe, for asylum seekers and refugees was already pretty dire, and the Greek islands in particular, but not only. I think what happens with lockdown is then that places of confinement become de facto places of detention. So the state should even have stronger obligations to let people move if their health is being imperiled. But of course, that hasn't happened there. And with regard to maritime practices and pushbacks, it seems that the current evidence in Greece is of both increased border violence on the Greek-Turkish border and also new forms of maritime refoulement, including copying some Australian practices of putting people afloat in small tented dinghies in order to prevent them from actually reaching Greek territory, although they would already be in Greek territorial waters. So legally, Greece is entirely responsible for what would happen. So on that front, I think most of the practice that I've seen in terms of states that were already engaging in dubious border control measures, anti-refugee border control measures, I think has gotten worse. In those sorts of instances, it's difficult to see what there aren't any quick fixes. I mean, in the US, almost every aspect of what the Trump administration has done touching on asylum and migration control has been legally challenged and is under challenge. I think with Greece, similarly, there have been so many applications to the European Court of Human Rights for what are called Rule 39 measures, interim measures to decongest the Greek islands and remove vulnerable individuals from confinement and places of detention. But it's really there a bit of a war of attrition against recalcitrant governments that aren't taking these obligations seriously.
And just to kind of double click on this area of refoulement and the justification of certain practices towards refugees based on what you describe as the sort of disingenuous use of public health measures, do we need to know whether the invocation of public health is actually disingenuous? Or are there just certain things that, regardless of the motive, governments simply shouldn't be doing towards refugees, particularly in terms of that right to non-refoulement, to not return people or push them back to countries where they face serious harm?
Yeah, well, I think legally that's a hugely important clarification. So thanks for giving me the reminder to clarify it. So I think non-refoulement belongs up there with torture, the prohibition on torture and the right to life in the sense of being non-derogable. And it's also, in certain aspects of the norm, absolute. So what that means is that there isn't any basis for derogating from non-refoulement in cases of emergency because it's a very minimal norm. I mean, it doesn't require you to let people live on your territory forever. It just requires that you don't send them back to immediate, well, it's formulated in different ways in different contexts, but let's say to a real risk of a serious human rights violation. So it creates certain procedural and substantive obligations on the state in question. So it's non-derogable in time of emergency, and also it's absolute in the sense that returning people to certain type of risks is absolutely prohibited. So there's no possible justification. What could be justified in a public health emergency are, you know, quarantining, obviously, and confining people for a short period of time, which international human rights law already permits for asylum seekers, even if you don't have an additional public health rationale. So I think that clarification is crucial about non-refoulement. It is really seen as a baseline. And when Michelle Foster and I looked at this pretty exhaustively, we said that not only is it a norm of customary international law, but it's also ripe for recognition as jus cogens. So that means it belongs to those norms that in the international system states accept as having a particularly elevated status.
Thank you, Catherine. I want to pick up on the fact that you said that countries who are already violating certain international human rights laws continue to do so, and to do so more intensely under the COVID-19 pandemic as a sort of excuse. But are there any policies that have been particularly effective internationally that you've seen that have in fact led to reforms or positive reforms with regards to asylum seekers and migrants seeking to be housed in the country?
I mean, it's such a varied picture, but I think the instances where the pandemic has triggered, let's say, positive changes relate, I think, in particular to security of residence issues. And also, there's a really varied picture in relation to immigration detention. So some states, Portugal, for example, and to a lesser extent, Italy, have regularized the status of people with an irregular migration status, which can have a very strong public health rationale as well as a very strong human rights rationale. I mean, if you have people who live in the shadows in fear of the authorities, they also, generally speaking, don't avail of healthcare, and this becomes a public health issue in a pandemic. So I think regularization is something I've always kind of tended to view in terms of a human rights lens, because it also means people are less vulnerable to other human rights violations. And in some contexts, states have taken a fairly enlightened view of immigration detention questions. As I said, international human rights law doesn't prohibit immigration detention, but it limits it very significantly. Outside of the pandemic, there was just a very strong view that, well, if, for example, deportations aren't going to happen, which is what you might imagine in a pandemic characterized by massive mobility restrictions, then you would say the rationale for detention falls away, because a lot of immigration detention is meant to be pre-deportation detention. And also, of course, there's a public health or an individual right to health question about detention conditions and the massively increased risk of viral transmission and the kinds of conditions people live in immigration detention. And in some countries, they just took a very quick, enlightened decision to release people from immigration detention. Again, Portugal is an example of that. The UK in practice released a lot of immigration detainees, but it was in a kind of, again, a war of attrition with NGOs, in particular Detention Action, which was going into court both with applications en masse and also supporting BID and other NGOs that bring individual bail applications for detainees. So a much more hard fought, I think, battle in the UK. And lots of people are still in immigration detention in the UK. But the overall pattern that I've seen documented, and there are a couple of global NGOs that monitor this, like the Global Detention Project, is that even in states that released a lot of prisoners for right to health reasons, they didn't release immigration detainees, even though the rationale and the justification for detaining immigration detainees, I think, is much weaker ethically and legally than it is for prisoners. Again, I think that's something that's really telling about how the human rights of irregular migrants in particular are so at risk in the way that migration control justifies extreme restrictions on their human rights, even without putting the pandemic into the mix.
So you raised the issue of irregular migrants, and even in sort of normal times, they're a population that face particular difficulties in having recourse to justice, to legal aid, to legal advice, to the courts. That must create the conditions under which it's possible for governments to engage in practices that are less scrutinized under the pandemic, and where there is very limited recourse for those people. How can you think about that as an international lawyer? What needs to happen to ensure that, in practical terms, these kinds of violations perpetrated against people in very vulnerable positions who don't, as individuals, have recourse to law, can report them and have appropriate outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive question because it's a multifaceted problem. But I guess the status of irregular migrant, I guess, is one we have to remember that that's a creation of domestic law. So that's not a preordained given. A lot of irregular migrants are actually unrecognized refugees, or people who could be refugees but choose not to register as refugees in the kind of states where that brings you a lot of disadvantages. Or they're people who had a migrant worker permission, but they left it because it was awful. So if you're under a tied work visa in the UK or in the kafala system in the Gulf or in Lebanon, you're actually much better off as an irregular migrant in some ways, although you're under a lot of other stresses and vulnerabilities too. So the category isn't a given, and it's a creature of domestic law, and it's very easy to be semi-illegal or semi-irregular too. If you're a student in the UK on a student visa and you work too many hours a week, are you then illegal? I think the universities that monitor your visa status might give you the sense that you are. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's a category that includes lots of different types of scenarios and individuals. But I think crucially, it's not a creature of international law. It's you're irregular in your status due to some feature of domestic law, and it might be a highly arbitrary one that itself isn't very legal. So I would want to unpack the status. Then in terms of the lived predicament, I think what we typically see with irregular migrants is that they work in whatever context might, broadly speaking, be regarded as the informal economy. Though sometimes the informal economy is, you know, a thriving urban economy, and other times it means transactional sex in a refugee camp where there are no other options. So I think the label doesn't really reveal very much there either. So I think work rights are crucial, and that can be either through a campaign for regularization or just campaigns for decent work, which downplay questions of migration status. I was really interested to see that in the wave of global protests about Black Lives Matter, that kafala and tied work visas are also being called out in a racial way, which I think is accurate and really important. I think in the literature about irregular migrant working, I think the question that you posed, Alex, about irregular migrants being sort of in the shadows and not having access to justice is often addressed by the idea of firewalls, which is that your migration status is just one aspect of your legal personality, but it shouldn't bar your access to justice or to other state services. And so there should be a firewall between immigration enforcement and other public services. And that you can see the practical appeal of that argument. And certainly it's egregious when you have systems set up where migration status and information about migration status becomes shared and institutionalized widely, because that would mean that irregular migrants can be deprived of a whole range of other rights, in particular irregular migrant children. And I think both constitutional and human rights law has done some good work in at least, and say even in the US, where human rights law has a very weak foothold in the constitution, but at least the position of, say, irregular migrant children and the right to education would be constitutionally protected. Or say a right like healthcare, where you would say, well, irrespective of your migration status, nobody has any business depriving you of access, at least to emergency medical treatment. But I've always felt that firewall arguments are kind of, you know, you're in the realm of the not even the second best, it's a kind of a third best argument, because the real issue is with the kind of precarious migration status that people live under. So I'm much more, I guess I find much more inspiration in regularization practices framed as human rights claims, where people say, look, we live here, we work here, that makes us part of society, therefore we should have a secure right of residence. And that also highlights the fact that it's precarious migration status that creates a whole lot of insecurity, where you can be totally legal in a country, but that doesn't give you any freedom to exercise even labor market rights. So if you have a 6-month visa or a yearly visa that needs renewal, you can be legal for years in a country, or a seasonal worker repeatedly legally working in a country, but yet be economically extremely precarious and in a position of acute dependency on your employer or on some employer to renew your work visa. And all of that creates very heightened risks for labor exploitation. So I would like to focus that discussion very much on questions about migration status and security of residence, rather than thinking only about firewalls and better treatment of irregular migrants, because I think that it deflects us away from the heart of the problem, really, which is how migration status is generated in the first place.
Coming towards the end of the discussion now, is there anything in particular that people listening to the podcast would like they should take away with them? What are the points that COVID-19 has brought to attention in terms of human rights and migration laws? And what do you think the future is in terms of the kind of incredibly unstable international and domestic environment that COVID-19 has led to the safeguarding and precarity of migrants and asylum seekers?
I think I'd like to end on an optimistic note, although I don't generally. I think what the pandemic has done is obviously it reveals how interconnected the world is, which is both a massive risk. And so we all are subject to the same risks. And this is really obvious from the pandemic, but that we all sort of also share the same resources and the same opportunities and the same opportunities for political gains. So I think that's important. I think it's also been very useful in reminding people about what sort of work is valuable. I'm not sure that's always translated into thinking about what sort of workers are valuable. So it's been really extraordinary to see exceptions to international mobility restrictions being made for certain types of agricultural workers, for example, but then not ensuring their health and safety at work. So that's been the case even in Germany and Canada. They've been pretty egregious examples. But I do think there's been at least there has to be an acknowledgement of what type of work is valuable in this context. And I also sort of take heart in the sense that it's very hard to generalize that the trends in human rights litigation or in human rights discourse. But it does seem to me that the indivisibility of civil and political rights and socioeconomic rights is really apparent. And the way that, say, the right to food is just acknowledged in this context. And of course, it dovetails then into bigger debates about economic security, global basic income, you know, how are people expected to live with no safety net of economic security? And I think I'm sort of heartened by the way that discussion is taking shape.
Catherine, you've really taught us a lot about the relationship between human rights and migration control in the pandemic era. This has been incredibly clear and helpful particularly for non-lawyers like me and I suspect also Mia and our listeners. You've given us a really structured account of what human rights are, how they have an effect, and the many ways in which migrants and refugees in particular face restrictions on their human rights at the current time. But you've also given a sense of optimism that courts are acting around the world, that there are legal challenges to some of the most egregious practices, and that human rights have a really important role to play in ensuring that even at a difficult time, some of the most vulnerable people have access to justice. So thank you very much for sharing your ideas, your work, your reflections with us, and enabling a wider audience to really understand what's at issue in the relationship between human rights and migration control.
Thanks, Alex, and thanks, Mia.
And that's all from us. Thank you for listening to Oxford Development Talks. Please head over to our websites, qeh.ox.ac.uk and oxford.org, for more information and the rest of the series. Or take a look at our Facebook pages. For any of our listeners who are interested to find out a bit more about Catherine's work and the topics covered in the podcast, please take a look at the handout attached to the blurb. A big thank you to Lorcan Cudlip Cook for the music. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And please join us next time.